Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, the Retina Podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of intraretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today in episode 428, we bring you the May 2024 preview of Retinal Physician. This episode focuses on the retinal prosthesis, low vision aids, home monitoring, and digital OR aids. Thanks again to Drs. Talcott and Zahid for joining me for this episode. Remember, listeners, you can find a list of all of our episodes on our website at retinapodcast.com. And a link is in the episode description to claim CME credits for older episodes.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with the preview of the May 2024 edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online and print, online at retinalphysician.com. And joining me for this episode, two of my colleagues from around the country, Drs. Kat Talcott is in Cleveland, Ohio. Kat, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we have Sarwar Zahid in New York.
Thanks, Jay. It's great to be back.
I had to get two spicy people because, you know, these articles are things that retina specialists may not want to think about or talk about much, but they're important. So let's get right into it. So I think it's interesting that the peer-reviewed article is about the retinal prosthesis by Jade Moon, Richard Sather, and Sandra Montezuma from Minnesota. And so this is called Overview of Retinal Prosthesis and Future Directions. And as a reminder, we're going to go through these articles. People can go and read the full article. We're not going to recap every part of it, but we're going to kind of hit the key points and then use it for discussion. So they talk a little bit about the different types of devices that are available. And if you separate devices into sections, it depends where you put the device. Is it epiretinal? Is it subretinal? Is it suprachoroidal? Or is it cortical or central? And I thought this was an interesting sort of review. I hadn't really thought about many of these things in recent years. I think in terms of epiretinal devices, the famous ones, Argus II was probably the most famous example of an epiretinal device on the surface of the retina, and essentially how it's working, right, is it's taking advantage of existing ganglion cells. You have a transmitter as well, wear glasses, and you sort of get some images, something that allows functionality. There are limitations to all these devices, and epiretinal devices seem to have a ceiling effect in terms of how good your vision gets. But it was, as they said, the first and only FDA-approved retinal prosthesis, the Argus II. However, 2019, Second Sight discontinued, only 350 of these devices were put in. And it's interesting that paragraph sort of ends with that statement. And then there's what's happened in the last 5 years if you're a patient or doctor reading. And the short answer, unfortunately, is not much. You know, I think those patients, you know, it kind of became an orphan sort of disease, an orphan sort of project. Now, subretinal diseases, I think there's a bunch of companies that have looked at putting a subretinal implant. Prima or Pixium, Iridium, these are all companies, Boston Retinal Implant, that are looking in trials. It looks like it's tolerable, but you essentially have to make some sort of incision in the retina to insert these devices. You have to get them in the subretinal space. And that's why suprachoroidal may be easier. We've looked at suprachoroidal for drug delivery, but people have talked about maybe you put the suprachoroidal. However, they do talk about the issue with suprachoroidal is you have larger distance from the neurosensory retina, so they have to have more power. Again, things I had not really thought about. And there's greater risk of hemorrhage because these devices are not small, and it's not like putting a little suprachoroidal drug in the suprachoroidal space, you're putting a device. So would there be sort of a learning curve? What sort of safety would be involved with that? And they talk about how, and I'll quote, preliminary data suggests that suprachoroidal devices are more limited because the greater spread of the current reduces spatial resolution, meaning that you're spreading the current over a greater area of retina, you're not getting the same sort of effect as epiretinal. So maybe even a lower ceiling than that. And then, you know, they talked very briefly, I looked at the optic nerve stimulation. There's not, you know, the very, very early sort of study from Japan they talk about. And then cortical devices, something in the visual cortex, bypass the eyes completely, go straight to occipital lobe and see if you can put an electrode implant, pair it with some sort of device that gives patients, that captures images and gives patients some sort of stimulation. The biggest thing, again, that's going to be out of our hands. Very few of us are going to be putting in cortical implants, although we may be involved in sort of follow-up and testing. So I thought, Kat, this is a really interesting article just in the sense of it's frustrating on one sense because, you know, none of these are available right now. But as they talk about, there's 15 different devices. They talk about all different sort of mechanisms. I think it's interesting, again, because it's taking us back to neurobiology, neuroscience. Like, how do you sort of fix the unfixable problem, right? We already talk about a whole eye transplant, things like that, to try to fix problems that we've considered unfixable. But is this a fixable problem? People have thought really hard about how you would approach it. I mean, what did you gain the most from this article, and what are your thoughts on retinal prosthesis, right? People, I feel it sort of died down in sort of our meetings over, since Argus fell out of favor, and since people have started talking more about, you know, gene therapy, stem cell therapy, autologous. I mean, I feel like people aren't as high on retinal prosthesis, but do you think there's a role long term for these?
Yeah, I mean, I thought this article was really interesting. I think you did a really nice job summarizing it. The thing that I was struck by, I think like you were, is that there's so much stuff out there in development, which is interesting because, as you mentioned, Argus is not supported anymore because in part the company ran into financial problems. So it's interesting to me that there's so much focus and investment in these other devices when, you know, I think it's hard to know from like my perspective if there's really enough of a market for this. The other thing I thought was sort of really interesting is I just ended up putting a talk together, an update for like inherited retinal diseases. And there, the focus is so much on like engaging in some of these patients earlier with like gene therapy. But this is kind of an approach, you know, where you're supporting sort of later stage patients. And the other thing that I was sort of wondering while I was reading this and I was interested to hear your guys' thoughts is like some of these technologies like really require sort of a lot from our patients to kind of interpret things. You know, sometimes there's like an adaptability too. And I just wonder with some of these systems, like what is that going to look like? Exciting to have stuff in the pipeline, but I was just kind of left with a lot of questions at the end of the article.
Yes. Sorry, this guy's right before we got here, we talked a little bit, you know, the healthcare system is obviously an interesting place, right? Because at the same time, you have wonderful innovation and science and really putting the individual patient first, which is what I think we were talking about here, because talking about very niche sort of patient selection. And to Kat's point, you would need sort of a high degree of investment in education. Argus proved that to get patients to use this. This is the humanistic side of medicine, is like, I want to help each individual person to get the most out of it they can. I think that's what most doctors aspire to do. But on the flip side of it, you have an economics and a system that isn't set up for that. You know, patients' biggest complaint people have is it's harder to get appointments. It's harder to get face chair time with a physician or a provider. It's harder to have those long conversations. Multiple reasons for that, right? Reimbursement pressures, costs, more investment money and private money in medicine versus public money. You could talk about the burnout in medicine. You could talk about just there's fewer, not enough providers, there's shortages. How are you going to sort of invest the resources? So one of the things that Kat brought up is interesting is the resource investment beyond the technology that it costs something. There's a huge time investment to get each patient sort of prepped to use the devices. And I think that that's something that's underrated in trial patients. All these devices go through trial for approval. But if you're really thinking for, I want to take this to market, I want to help the most people I can, which is simultaneously going to help my business or help my product do well, you really have to think about what is the chair time involved. And I think that there's not enough discussion of this in the trial setting because maybe it's just too much to wrap your head around. But that goes back to applicability. Can you take this and extrapolate it to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 people? And with Luxturna, the price point had to be so high to sort of justify it because Luxturna wasn't even you had to train. There was just so much involved from the company side to support patients in a very orphan-like disease. I just wonder if that's something we're missing here too in this discussion. Kat brings it up. It's like, what are you? How user-friendly does your device have to be? And it's not just about working. Is it, can it work? And can it work without a patient needing to do hours and hours of sort of learning, coaching, things like that to get to learn to use it?
Yeah, the training part is really interesting because the investment on the patient is, you know, they have to sit there and train their brain to convert these electrical stimuli into like, okay, this is a square. I mean, that's a very simplistic way of looking at it, but that's a major time investment. And that's not something that we can sort of accommodate in our practices. And we deal with this, we've discussed this many times about the chair time. We're dealing with this with the GA medications. That's, you know, there are multiple conversations and oftentimes the same conversations and then, you know, repeating the same conversation with a family member before someone makes an investment with these medications. This is even more than that because it requires the training. And I think that's something we would need to address. I mean, first off, like the reimbursement, I mean, the amount of time that that patient takes, is that being reimbursed properly? Or as you mentioned, you know, which is a great point, is the reimbursement sort of, you know, irrespective of the reimbursement, is the price point of these procedures so potentially lucrative that people put in the extra time? So those are things that I think the market will have to figure out with the market. overall, this article, I thought, I mean, I agree with, you know, great points by both of you. I mean, it was a nice reminder. I would have wanted to know what happened with those patients. You know, I mean, I know there are review articles out there, but just to sort of put the picture together in this article to see, okay, some of these patients who now have another 5 years of training, if it's the implant is still in the eye, have they demonstrated the plasticity and adaptability to use this technology even better? So I'd want to know that. The subretinal implant, I think, is super interesting because at least the way it looks is, you know, the retinotomy is not huge, but it's sort of like a foldable IOL that expands. So I think that's very exciting because that can give us the opportunity to expand, use a larger size. So that's exciting. And there's, I mean, 20 years from now, this conversation may be very different because, you know, there's the development of further nanotechnology, you know, especially when it comes to the optic nerve. Could we stimulate a specific optic nerve with like multiple nano size electrodes? So I thought it's a nice reminder for all of us because patients are always asking us, you know, it's like, is there any way, can you put a bionic eye? And, you know, we can say, no, we can't, but there are some things in development for these end stage GA patients. Yeah.
Well, and this is going to, we can keep talking about this, but I'm going to tie it to the next article, which is this article about Thomas Finley about new growth in low vision assistive technology. And as a note, he did list that he's an investor and chair for OcutarX, but he goes through about the idea. I mean, low vision is a problem. That's why we're talking about these devices. He talked about 4 million Americans have low vision, which is considered best corrected vision, worse than 20/40, which when you think about it that way, I mean, that is a lot of retina clinics. Maybe I think that's underestimating how many patients based on the patients we see in our clinics. And they talk about different wearable technologies that would avoid a surgery, right? And you need some baseline degree of vision. These are different sort of patients, but wearable technology, things like eSight, aSight, Vision Buddy, i5, glasses or headsets that are magnifying images, that are sometimes using VR technology, that are giving patients some ability to improve. And this is really the focus. He does reference sort of the public service announcement at the end, is that most retina specialists don't bring up low vision patients. Refer your patients to low vision. We've said this on podcast support. Tell your patients to get a low vision eval. Know who your local, like here it's the Braille Institute, and Miami was the Lighthouse for the Blind. There is somebody locally who can help. Does it fix everything? It doesn't. But it is important to get patients connected. I mean, Kat, what do you think about these wearable devices? Because I'll be very honest, anecdotally, I haven't had patients be super impressed, I would say it's a very narrow group of patients that are actually helped by this in my experience. And I don't know, again, maybe I'm underestimating them. Maybe it's about people training them to use it. Maybe it's about expectations relative to reality. But I've, you know, anytime a patient's brought it up or they've gone and done it, I've been a little bit underwhelmed by what the patient has told me about their experience.
I agree. I think that's a really good point. I think as I was reading this article, I was like thinking about most of my patients who I send to low vision. We have the Cleveland Sight Center, which is great, but we also have an optometrist who does like low vision rehab in our system. And she is amazing, works with an occupational therapist and spends a ton of time with people. And I was thinking about all the patients I sent to her and the ones who have gotten the most out of it, like, how would they utilize that on a day-to-day basis? And most of them are like elderly, right? They're like over the age of 80, you know, they have GA. Most of them live alone and are trying to get by living alone and doing their things. And I have to admit, I just have a hard time seeing them function with like wearing a device and figuring out, you know, whatever technology is associated with it at home by themselves. Because a lot of my patients who have seen low vision come back and they're like, yeah, they tried all these things, but you know, I just got like a better lighted magnifier and that's like what I want. You know, it sounds like from my perspective, for the majority of people, like they want something like that, or they want, you know, some sort of just, you know, pair of glasses that's going to fix everything, which is that. So I think this technology is really cool. I have to admit, I have some reticence about seeing sort of my bread and butter, like AMD, or, you know, you could say like, you know, glaucoma people or whatever, sort of, really sort of adapting well to some of this technology.
Yeah, that's great points, Kat. And to tie into that, so where, I mean, obviously there's different degrees of vision loss. We're very blessed to live in a time where there's some low vision aids people use on a daily basis. They're for iPhone, their iPad, screens. Like there's a lot of negatives to screens, but we've all seen patients who have shifted reading books or newspapers. They're able to use contrast. You're able to use a screen, magnify the print. it doesn't solve everything, but again, we have to sort of maybe step away. We talk about this with GA, but with low vision. I mean, part of our job as doctors is not to solve every problem, but it's to improve quality of life and to help people sort of use what they have to the maximal ability when we can't fix problems. Any experience with wearable technology? I the problem with the wearable technology market too, and I won't, none of these companies, I don't know enough about any of these devices. It is sort of rife for exploitation, right? I mean, this is part of the problem that's come up too, is there are devices like these that are validated or maybe going through a very regimented low vision institute that's kind of regulating what comes in and out. But then I'll have patients show up with this internet glass they found or something like this. And you know, most of it, unfortunately, it's people taking advantage of other people. It's similar to the stem cell therapy fake clinics. It's like, this is a really sad arena of our field that, again, we probably don't do enough chair time talking to patients about. And when they don't get the chair time, then they look for other ways to sort of cope. What are your thoughts on wearable technology and your own experiences with it, Sarwar?
I don't have a ton of experience with it. I am a poquito investor in Idaptic, but I mean, I want to say, I think one of the challenges I face with our low vision patients is getting them, you know, into a low vision specialist in a timely manner. I mean, I think the reimbursement isn't necessarily great in the market for there to be enough of these providers. And I think that's something that we need to address. I agree. I've also not had, I have not had patients come back and say, oh my God, you know, like it really changed my life, you know? I mean, and I think some of these augmented reality devices are promising, especially if it's sort of using the machine learning technology that we have to remap an image to an area that's outside the blind spot. I mean, this all sounds really great, but I'd want to see how it actually improves the day-to-day lives of our patients. That also requires training because it requires an investment by the patient in order to, so the machine can learn how to best help the patient. And, you know, I mean, it's funny, you know, you mentioned the iPhones and how we all use, you know, the technology in our phones. And I've seen so many of our attendings stave off presbyopia with the bigger font, you know, identify as not presbyopic. So I just remember a lot of my attendings in residency. But I think one of the things that you mentioned about exploitation is huge, because even our patients who don't have low vision, they go to a optical shop and end up dropping $800-$900 for a lot of things that technologically, I mean, we as retina specialists are a bit removed from this because we don't work on the optical side, but there's this happens, you know, with, you know, blue blocking glasses, high index lenses, all these things that happen. I mean, the glasses I'm wearing now are high index, you know, I mean, and added substantially to the cost. And the stem cell thing is a great reference point because these are patients who have no hope. So it's very easy for exploitation. The question is, how do we monitor that? How do we set up regulations for that? Because some of these may end up being cash-based procedures if the reimbursement is not, if it's not reimbursed, and patients will pay if they're offered some sort of hope.
It's going to be like the new AREDS vitamins. There's going to be like, but you have to buy this expensive one. You can't just get the regular one at the drugstore, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, like, this is the hard part, right? Is because you want to stay open-minded. You want to stay, if you become closed-minded, then you close off options for patients. You could just keep doing the same medicine now that you've learned in residency or fellowship. And then 20 years later, you're a dinosaur and you're not evolving and adapting. But at the same time, it's operating within reason, right? It's sort of like, and this is the hard part, not everything is validated in a trial, but it's like, how many times how open-minded can you be, right? And the stem cell conversation, this comes up, Sarwar, as you referenced, it comes up with these visual aids. It's really fascinating. And you throw in the insurance coverage, you know, insurances don't coverage prostheses ever enucleation a lot of times, right? Like the insurance landscape is so interesting because it takes care of your most serious problems, but not the final thing you end up with. Like, you obviously need a prosthesis if you're going to have an enucleation, but it's not always covered. And it would be a lot cheaper for the system to help someone get visual aids and get them to be more functional than to pay thousands of dollars for, you know, X new injectable drug on the market, right? But this is a very different sort of approach. And we have this telemonitoring article, we can briefly touch base, by Miguel Busquets and Matt Tracy, talking about telemonitoring. We've talked about telemonitoring, I feel like, three times a year. I feel like there's an article, and this is not a criticism, but I say this each time because it is a really hot topic because of the provider shortage and because of the disease issues. And they talk about the existing platforms, and they talk about things that may be available in the future. But the existing platforms, right, 4C Home, and they talk about some of the evidence of 4C Home. They talk about MyVisionTrack and MacuStat, Heru, ROP telemonitoring, you know, DR monitoring. I mean, these things are making inroads in the background while we continue to operate our clinics and inject our patients and move on with life. But I think that the cost part of it, they talk about future home OCT. How does home OCT work? Like, Kat, I just think, again, how does it get paid for? Who pays for it? How does it implement it, right? These are the things that are hard to define because I don't think there is a great model for this in other fields of medicine. In fact, ophthalmology is probably the best setup because it's a visual field, because it's image-based. Radiology can argue, but no one's going to get a home chest x-ray, right? So what? How does it work from a payer standpoint? How does it work from a patient standpoint? And, you know, I think that this, again, would be high benefits to society, but for an individual, maybe not as high benefits. How do you justify that and rationalize that in the payer system?
Yeah, I think those are really good points. The home OCT thing, I think, is really interesting. And I think about every time this is like presented at a conference and everyone in the audience gets like so excited about it. I have to admit, I just kind of think through like how this is going to play out in my clinic, right? Like somebody has a home OCT. Are they going to call me when they're having problems using it instead of like the device company? And then if it goes off and it detects something, I just kind of play through how that's going to work of like getting them in. So they're going to call to get in. Should I like then start saving like appointment slots like for my clinics for these like home OCT patients who are just going to be like flex added? And then I can see like these older patients getting like, you know, worried and upset that they need to get in like right away, but then they need to arrange like transport, and transports can't come this day, but they come on this day from their assisted living facility. I don't know. It's going to just be interesting to see how that plays out. And as you mentioned, like who's paying for this, you know, and what's that looking like, you know, the like 4C device. I just have patients, to be honest, I've inherited who are on it, but just like the forms that are needed and like, you know, there's just a lot of pragmatic things to sort of think through.
Sarwar, what do you think?
I think the potential to reduce, especially, you know, these trials that look at treat and extend versus using home OCT, for example, I think it's exciting, right? Especially when in this article, I mean, I personally don't have any patients that have utilized any of these devices like the 4C. I think it's really sounds really nice when it's like, oh, the company will take care of everything, you know. And if that's truly the case, sure, that sounds fantastic. If the entire training, the benefits verification, to make sure the training for the patient, reimbursement for, you know, if we don't have to think,
but if that's all true, Sarwar, why has it not been utilized more?
I'm not sure. I mean, it's
Kat, do you have theories? I mean, I have my theories. They're cynical, but what do you think?
I mean, the other thing that I'm worried about is like, if they start covering this, like, are we going to be getting reimbursed less than we are now? You know, are they going to make us step through how many other anti-VEGF agents to get to something? I don't know. What's your theory on why it's not?
I mean, my theory is, again, it's cynical, but again, physicians don't get paid to as well. And it's not, so like retina practice is very, you help a lot of people, but it's very profitable in a lot of ways, right? You know, and so people fall into their rhythms. And anytime you have something that breaks your rhythm, you don't want to incorporate it unless it makes sense, right? And this does make sense. I think it does make sense to integrate 4C home, but there is going to be an activation energy to your point, Sarwar. And so maybe people just are not willing to break their rhythm, whether it's financial, whether it's just the rhythm of getting through my clinic day, to integrate this into their clinics. And then it doesn't fit into their model of how they run their clinics. It doesn't fit into their treat extend model. It doesn't fit in to the way they follow disease. And people are operating, unfortunately, a lot of times on autopilot. And so you'd have to completely paradigm shift some things in your mind and how you run your clinic. There's a money part to it, but I'm just saying in terms of just flow and how people think. I don't know what you think. That would be my thought for why more providers haven't adopted.
I mean, because I just started my practice, I'm not facing the crunch of like, oh, I really need to decompress my clinics at this point. You know, I mean, I still have capacity. So I'd really want to know how people who have mature retina practices, who truly can't necessarily add patients without potentially adding a provider see this specific question? Because, you know, we always say this, right? It's like, oh, you know, our clinics are really getting busy. We need AI to absorb all these patients. But, you know, AI has been around. You know, we have two FDA approved, I believe two FDA approved AI systems. Why are we not utilizing them more? And I think, you know, this is actually, you know, I'd want to know the opinions of a lot of the doctors with immature practices where you're making the decisions like, okay, I'm booked out for 3 months, you know, or 2 months. At this point, I have to either add a doctor or add a, you know, another site to add capacity or decompress my clinics. And something like this would decompress your clinics. And whether the financial incentive is playing a role there, the best people to ask, I think, are people in that position who are at that crossroads of making that decision.
I guess, yeah. I'm worried that, and if I'm thinking, you know, from the cynical part of my brain of like, this is the part of me that like hates getting Epic messages. And I'm like, how many more Epic messages am I going to get in the middle of my clinic? But like, I don't know if like these devices are going to mean sort of more efficient, you know, less demand on our clinics. Like, if you have a system where it's all tied together, like, you know, your system is doing the screening and then, you know, following up on things and getting people in maybe, but like, I don't know. I just, the pessimist part of me is just like, this is just going to be more patients for us to take care of necessarily because this thing went off or got pinged that I don't necessarily need to see.
This ties a little bit into the last article, which was Digital Operating Room. John Miller, Melissa Yuen wrote this from SI. And again, they talk about just sort of the evolution of tools that we have in the OR, whether that's head-mounted displays, 3D heads-up, you know, Artivo, Ingenuity, the benefits ergonomically, the benefits in terms of teaching, some of the contrast reduction in light intensity you could do with those systems. You know, you have the Bionics head-mounted displays, which has some advantages, potentially, again, lower end of illumination, ergonomics, maybe more immersive, and then robotic surgery, right? Something that people have been working on for cataract surgery, but also for retinal surgery. And finally, intraoperative OCT, which we have, but has continued to be integrated more and progress. Again, the economics, right? Like, I love all these ideas. I think the reason that it has been a struggle to get adoption has been, how do you convince in a system that has increasingly become harder for surgeons to find OR space in certain areas, to find ASCs, to find hospitals? How do you convince them to buy a new microscope? How do you convince them to upgrade the technology? How do you convince them to buy a heads-up display for you, right? Now, if they are going to buy one, you have one that's double the cost of another one. How do you, as the surgeon, advocate when you aren't the big money maker for that ASC typically, when it's the cataract folks? And maybe the cataract folks advocate for it. But you know what I'm saying? Like, Kat, I don't know. I love all these issues, but I feel like the conversation hasn't shifted in the last 4, 5, 6 years. We've come on the podcast, we've talked about these issues before. They continue to progress. 100%. This whole podcast has been about technology that has progressed. I agree. But all of it has been about applicability. Are we getting any closer to applying it to day-to-day surgery? And that's really the question here I have about the operating room technology before we wrap.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same pragmatic issues, as you mentioned. Like, whenever we want to buy a new scope for sort of our large group, you know, it has to go through committees. And basically, you know, any device that only helps some people and not everyone is really hard to get through. So the question is always just like, can the anterior segment surgeons use it? Can the retina people use it? Is everyone going to be happy with it? And, you know, we try out, like, I'm fortunate to be able to have tried out like most of these systems that we've had sort of through like research and other things, but, to be able to get one purchased is like really difficult because you have to get consensus and it's hard to get consensus on sort of new technology. Especially when like these devices are not cheap, you know?
Sour, you want to buy one for your office?
I would love to. You know, it's interesting. I have been trying to, you know, at every place I've operated, I've been trying to convince them to get some of these newer machines. It's like, oh, I want to try these other machines that, you know, whether it's, you know, the Biblade, the Doric Biblade or the heads up display, especially the Alcon one that, you know, I had the privilege of using during fellowship. But the tough thing is, you know, when we have something that works well enough and the machine isn't broken, the financial incentive is not there. And yeah, as you mentioned, we're not the big cash cow for an ASC, you know, and RD doesn't, you know, we've gone over articles about how the reimbursement for retina surgeries continues to go down. And actually you end up losing money on a 6, 7, 1, 3 complex RD repair. So I think that's really interesting. And My hope is that at my practice, at some point, I start doing intra-office OR. It's something I'm not at the point to consider, but as I build my practice, it's something I want to think about because that's when I can control that. The other thing that I think is really interesting is what's super exciting is using robotics to make us better surgeons. Like, for example, I mean, I think we talked about it before. It's like if you get a sort of audible warning when you're getting too close to the lens or too close to the retina, or if you're making an unsafe maneuver based on, what the video camera is picking up, I think that would make us better surgeons. Tremor reduction when we're doing macular work and things that are a bit more delicate would be phenomenal. However, if I'm an ASC, I'm just thinking about it from a financial standpoint. It's like, okay, but are we having bad outcomes from this? Like for example, reducing light toxicity with lower luminance levels sounds like a great idea, but how much light toxicity is there truly? And even though for us as physicians, the safety component to make us better surgeons sounds great, it's not until these prices come down, it's not going to be viable or sustainable. Or if we get some sort of feedback on safety. But the thing is, how can we truly monitor things like light toxicity, iatrogenic breaks that could have been prevented by robotic assistance? We don't have that.
And again, not to play devil's advocate, but would you go more crazy as a surgeon? Would you beat yourself up more for every analysis of your surgery? Would it make you a better surgeon? It probably would. But how about Kat's shaking her head? She's like, no.
I would just get more anxious. I'd be like, oh no, oh no, oh no. On the IC, I'm
I
doing something wrong. I'm
mean,
doing something wrong.
we record things for phaco. I'm staffing phacos today, right? CDE is there, the residents track their CDE. Like there is certain metrics that are tracked. We don't really track those for retina. Maybe operative length is probably the only thing we try to keep an eye on, and the vision's outcomes, right, after the surgery. But like it would be kind of interesting if you got like an analysis at the end of every your case that told you how well you did. What would that mean medical legally, right? Like a patient had a complication and you had a subpar OR experience that day, are you liable? I mean, there's so many things that probably not, but it's a weird world out there. I don't know. But again, I want to be open-minded to what you're saying, Sarwar, because I think it's so easy to go the other way and to say no. I do think that those things would be value adds. And I do think that even today I was talking to anesthesia about, and he was talking about how deep to put patients. And he was like, I don't like patients to sleep. It seems like it makes the eye surgeons more anxious. I'm like, well, the reasons we don't want them totally asleep is because sometimes they wake up. And I try to teach fellows to not hang out by the retina for too long because you're playing with fire. Every time you go down the peel, if that patient moves, your reaction time isn't fast enough to necessarily move if they move. You may feel them about to move and then you move, but you actually can't move fast enough if you're really down there. A robot could, maybe to your point, so a robotic assist could warn you or give you some safety that pulls back. So there is an added value for sure there. Anyway, I will let you guys go. I think this was a really good discussion. I really appreciate you guys both taking the time. Thanks for mentioning intra-op OR, Sarwar. We got a preview. We got an episode coming out on that next month. So guys, we'll look out for that. And Sarwar, sneak peek. Sarwar is not the featured guest on that program, but he isn't the first person to mention it here on the podcast. So he gets some credit. All right, guys, have a great day. Take care.
Thanks, Jay.
Many thanks again to Dr. Talcott Zahid for joining me for this episode. Listeners, remember you can find all of our episodes online at retinapodcast.com. Thanks to our whole production team, Drs. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, Mike Menacasa. Thank you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of on a daily basis. This is Jay Schrader, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.